From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, ethics and government. A local professor who's an expert on this explains how ethical behavior in politics can be encouraged and enforced. Plus, the art of DJing. Local artist DJ Oasis explains how he makes music out of samples and electronic sources. First, can deficit spending save an economy in recession? Economists have debated this issue for decades. It has, of course, returned to the fore thanks to the current recession and the Obama administration's huge economic stimulus plan. Two top economists will discuss the pros and cons of deficit spending at a debate tomorrow. It's actually being called a stimulus smackdown. You'll hear them in a moment, but first, here's the smackdown moderator, UC Davis economist Gregory Clark. Greg, welcome.
Hello.
Before we get to the economists and the stimulus smackdown, tell us about what inspired it. It was a piece you wrote for The Atlantic, wasn't it?
That's right, for The Atlantic monthly business blog. I had a piece just reflecting on the bizarre situation that economics was in now, where everyone is interested in economics precisely because economics has completely failed as an academic discipline to either predict the recession or to explain how to get out of it. And in that piece, I made some fun of high-paid theoretical economists, and one of them was one of our contestants in the Smackdown, Michaela Boldrin, who I falsely accused of actually earning a salary of more than $500,000 a year. And so he boldly corrected that, but then said he would like to come and actually debate the stimulus. And then the other contestant is Brad DeLong, who is from Berkeley, who is in favor of deficit spending, but who many of my macroeconomics colleagues would regard as not actually being a macroeconomist on that grounds.
I see. My guest in the studio is Greg Clark from UC Davis. He's an economist. Now, our two Smackdown economists were not available to talk at the same time on Insight. They will be there together tomorrow evening at UC Davis. This morning, I spoke with Michaela Boldrin, who is professor of economics and arts and sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. And he was one of the signatories of a full-page newspaper ad against using government spending as a tool to improve economic performance. And I asked him why he thinks spending, more spending, would not stimulate the economy.
We said the more government spending would not stimulate the economy, and not, I don't believe the economy needs to be stimulated. The economy needs to be cured. The economy is sick, that the stimulus is of no use. It's been already proved by what's going on the markets during the last week since the stimulus was approved. The problem is with the banks. The problem is with the balance sheet of the bank and their losses. And the problems are also with the saving and income of the American people. The problem is not with the lack of public spending.
You said the economy doesn't need to be stimulated, it needs to be cured. Specifically, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that the situation in which we are is clearly caused by mistakes, both of policy and design and regulation, and also market mistakes and investment mistakes of at least the last 10 years. To put it in a nutshell, on the financial system of the United States is in a bad situation. They've made wrong investment by leveraging, by borrowing, exposing themselves to the risk, to very large risk that they cannot afford with the capital. So we have essentially a large chunk of the financial system and the large banks in particular that are like zombies, unable to perform their function, which is the function of transferring and redirecting saving from people that's household that save to companies and individuals that want to invest. That's the first problem. So we need to fix the financial system and make it function again, make it do its job. Second, we have a large part of the population, maybe in the order of 20-30% of the household, that for a reason or another are sitting on mortgages that are larger than the market value of their houses. And those mortgages they either cannot pay because their income are not expected to be enough, or they're not willing to pay because they don't believe it's worth paying a mortgage that is bigger than than the market value of your house. So that's the second problem that we need to address, and that problem can only be addressed by facilitating the disposal of houses that are clogging the market, by facilitating the redefinition of mortgage terms so that they become affordable and losses are split between households that are borrowing and banks that are lending, and in particular by facilitating the finding of jobs. People need people employed in a set of industries that are for which there is no growth, that are no productive, for which there is no demand, need to find job in other industry. Generic demand coming from the public sector is just not going to help that. People that are now, that have been employed in the last few years, producing, building houses in areas of the country where people don't want houses anymore, need to find other jobs. That's what we policy should do.
Are you saying that if the financial system were fixed and the level of indebtedness in households, if that were fixed, that the economy would need no stimulating, that it would return to health under its own steam?
I would say so, yes, indeed. Let me make clear this thing about this word stimulus. I think it's, first of all, it's a misnomer. We're talking about public spending and some tax rebates. The reason I personally and many of the other designed that page and wrote articles on that, criticized that bill, is twofold. One, first, we think it's absolutely incorrect to give the American people the idea that that bill is the proper way to address the crisis. The proper way to address the crisis is the one I said, which is to address serious, profound, long-standing inefficiencies and dramatic contradiction in the financial system. So it's bad policy to tell people the stimulus or the financial spend package is the way to go. That doesn't address the issue. Second, there are parts of that package that obviously I support, such as the extension of the unemployment benefits, some of the tax reduction, and there are other parts, such as, for example, increased public spending for education and so on, that would be fine as a part of President Obama administration general policy. What I criticize and disagree is to sell these parts that I agree with as if they have anything to do with or to help with the economic crisis we are facing. They don't. They're part of an agenda the one may agree with or may disagree. They're fine on their own ground. They certainly have very little effect on what's happening right now.
What impact do you think that the parts of the Obama plan that are considered to be stimulus, economic stimulus, what impact do you think they will have on the economy?
I frankly, I have no idea. I mean, if what I have to consider economic stimulus is immediate expenditure, immediate public expenditure, I feel they probably will have a negative impact. There's a large amount of pork in the spending that will take place during 2009 and 2010. There are pet projects of this or the other congressman that have very little to do with the general crisis. They'll create some demand, some public benefit in some areas of the country that are probably completely unrelated with people going unemployed in other parts of the countries, with the real estate and construction industry going down. So I very much doubt they will have any beneficial effect. As I said, it will be just a little bit more of extra pork, with no relation whatsoever with the true problem we are addressing.
There are many people who believe very strongly that increased government spending in the 30s helped pull the United States out of the Great Depression. Do you agree with that?
And obviously not. There is abundant research proving the opposite. I don't think there's any evidence that the so-called increase in government spending during the 30s helped to get out of the recession. Every piece of academic research produced in the last 15 years, and not just some theoretical piece, but data and historical evidence suggests that it was either not relevant or probably detrimental.
But there are economists who would say otherwise, that there is research to suggest that the U.S. was pulled out of, at least part of the process of pulling the country out of the Great Depression was the result of public works projects and other initiatives by the
well,
president.
Well, it's up to them to prove it. I insist, that's not what current and recent research on the Great Depression here suggests. And furthermore, there is another mistake that keeps being made, which is assuming by analogy that all economic crises are the same, and in particular they're all like the Depression one, the one between 29 and 39. there is absolutely no reason, again, to think that the crisis we are facing in this moment has the same characteristics, the same causes, and it's developing the same way as the crisis of 1929-39. So even assuming, and I insist, I don't believe it's true, but even assuming the sum of the public spending that took place during that period helped solving that crisis at all, there is no reason to infer from that that it should help this, because the nature, the reason, the way in which this, the dynamics of the present crisis are quite different. If there is a crisis that this one resembles and which has similar causes and a similar dynamics, the Japanese post-Nikkei and post-real estate bubble explosion of 92-2000, and in that case, there is abundant evidence that dramatically large increases in public spending had absolutely no positive effect on the stagnation which the Japanese economy felt. The Japanese government moved in the space of 10 years from a debt-to-GNP ratio of about 60% to a debt-to-GNP ratio that is currently, before a recession came back into Japan again, was about 190%. So they more than doubled the debt-to-GNP ratio, and the effect on the economy was essentially nil. The Japanese economy had started to grow again, a decent number, 2-3% a year, only after 2002-2003. That is only after, in a way or another, their financial system, their banking system got cured.
Okay. Michaela Baldrin, Distinguished Professor of Economics at Washington University in St. Louis, one of the signatories of a recent full-page newspaper ad against using government spending as a tool to improve the U.S. economy. He's also one of the speakers at tomorrow evening's economic stimulus debate at UC Davis. Michaela Baldrin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us now by phone live with another perspective is J. Bradford DeLong. He's professor of economics at UC Berkeley and chair of its political economy major. He served in the Clinton administration as a deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury. He's also taking part in tomorrow evening's stimulus smackdown, the economics debate at UC Davis. Brad DeLong, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, although bear with me because I just flew back from Washington and my arms aren't tired, but I did catch bronchitis on the plane.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you stand on the use of government spending to try and end a recession?
Well, I suppose at the moment I stand completely and totally bemused. Yeah, I find the arguments that Professor Baldrin is making and arguments being made by Republicans all around the country right now are arguments that haven't been seen since the 1920s, arguments that were last made in the 1920s and then were rejected as simply being totally wrong in their claims that government spending could not boost employment and production. Now, there's a question about whether you want to use government spending to boost employment and production. There's a question about, you know, what else will happen if you do this, and maybe sometimes you actually don't want more spending and production. Maybe that creates higher inflation. But there's no doubt that spending, that when any group of people, when the government decides to spend a lot more money, that it boosts employment and production. Remember 2003-2006? That wasn't that long ago. Between 2003 and 2006, we had capital inflows from Asia producing cheap money. We had easy money from the Federal Reserve. We had promises that financial engineering would cheaply diversify risk. And all of these things spurred home building companies to spend money, to spend a lot of money building houses. And the American unemployment rate fell from 6% to 4.8%. Remember 1996 to 2000, when the assembled investors of America discovered the Internet, and in response, businesses spent money like water on computers and telephones, and the American unemployment rate fell from 5.6% to 4.3%. In both of those very recent cases, when a group of people in America got enthusiastic and got up and started spending, unemployment went down and production went up.
But is there a difference between private...
In general, spending works to spur the economy, and the government's money, when spent, is as good as anybody else's.
So you're saying there's no difference...
So if home builders' money can boost output, and if internet barons' money can boost output, the government's money can boost output as well.
So Brad, just to make sure that we're clear here, you're saying there's no difference, effectively, economically, between government money and private money. If you're spending a lot of money in the economy,
well,
you're going to have a beneficial impact.
Employment and production. You're going to get different things because you're spending the money on different things. In the case of the home boom of the 2000s, we got a lot of four-bedroom houses in the desert outside of Los Angeles. In the case of the internet boom in the 1990s, we got Google and a whole bunch of dark fiber that gave us really cheap phone calls. There's a question about whether you actually want to do this, so whether you like the things, the stuff that money's being spent on. But there's absolutely no doubt that if there are a lot of unemployed people otherwise sitting idle who aren't doing anything productive, that finding someone to spend money, putting them to work, will put them to work and will push down the unemployment rate and diminish the number of jobless and get them doing something at least somewhat productive.
You probably heard Michaela Baldrin say that, as far as he could tell, all the current research into the Great Depression pointed to government spending being not the reason why the country was pulled out of the Great Depression.
Well, he didn't say why it was pulled out of the Great Depression, did he? You'll notice he very carefully avoided that. Right, that the economy was pulled out of the Great Depression by three factors. Right, first, the Roosevelt administration's decisions in 1933 to abandon the gold standard, and which did two things. First, it broke people's fear that prices were going to keep on declining, and so that meant that private businesses were willing to spend a whole bunch of money as well. And the second thing Roosevelt did was that he didn't actually like to run big deficits, but he wasn't convinced, like Hoover, that he had to balance the budget every single year. And so while Hoover had cut government spending every year from 1929 to 33, Roosevelt let it grow and let it grow along with the needs of the population for relief. And those two things, that increased private spending because people are no longer fearful of deflation and the fact that the government wasn't frantically slashing its budget every year, right, that helped somewhat. In the second half of the 1930s, right, Christina Romer, who used to be down the hall and now is in the White House, her view is that the second of the three big steps in recovery from the Great Depression came in the late 1930s when the Federal Reserve printed a whole bunch of additional money, when the money supply went way, way up. And, of course, the economy was pulled out of the Depression completely. Right, that is, the first two things that pushed the unemployment rate down from 25% to 10%. What pushed it down from 10% to 2% was the extraordinary wave of government spending in World War II, as the government grabbed everyone and spent money like water to try to build weapons. So certainly spending pulled the economy out of the Great Depression. Number three, the government spending during World War II. Number two, private spending made possible by easy money toward the end of the 1930s. And number one, the twin boosts that you got from the end of deflation improving private sector expectations and from the fact that the government was no longer slashing its budgets. So he's wrong about the Depression as well.
Finally, Brad, what's your overall reaction to the Obama economic stimulus plan? Do you think it's more or less right? Do you think it's really good? Do you have big problems with it?
Look, he started out saying, I'm going to be a bipartisan president. That even though I won the election, I'm going to do a stimulus package that's two-thirds spending increases and one-third tax cuts. In, say, contrast to what the Bush administration did back in 2003 when it passed a stimulus package that was 100% tax cuts and no spending increases. You know, in response, the Republicans kicked him in the teeth and said, ew, we don't like this. This isn't responsive. We're going to vote against it. We hope you fail. I think that the fact that Obama made a bunch of concessions to Republicans means the stimulus package is less effective than it would have been had it been properly designed. that instead of getting somewhat $800 billion of value out of it, we're only getting to get about $500 billion of value out of it, which is too bad because there'll still be $800 billion of debt to pay off. But it's still worth doing.
Okay. Brad DeLong, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Well, you've heard from the two economists who are going to be taking part in the stimulus smackdown. It's an economic stimulus debate tomorrow evening at UC Davis. Let's wrap this up again with Greg Clark at UC Davis. He's the instigator of this stimulus smackdown, and he's going to be moderating it tomorrow evening. Greg, any thoughts occur to you based on what we just heard from Michaela Baldrin and Brad DeLong?
Two things. One is it's clearly going to be a lively and informed debate. The second big question I have, though, is how to keep control of these two ferocious debating animals.
You said it's going to be informed, and there's no doubt about that. However, the information that these two economists bring to the debate does not seem to correlate.
Well, as
they don't seem to agree on some pretty fundamental issues.
Well, the big problem in macroeconomics is that we don't have controlled experiments. Japan's not an experiment in the 1990s. Lots of other things were happening. All these other episodes, Brad's building boom. Again, lots of other things are happening in the economy at the same time. And so that's what bedevils macroeconomics, is just our inability to actually do controlled experiments of the effects of things like stimulus.
Listening to Brad and Michaela, one would think that the reason or reasons why how the U.S. got out of the Great Depression is controversial, that there's almost no middle ground between these two sides. Is it, from your point of view, really a controversial, unsettled issue?
My own inclinations are more towards Brad on this side. But I have to say that within a vast number of academic macroeconomists in the United States now, there would be strong belief, for example, that the Great Depression was, among some, that the Great Depression was caused by a technological shock, that it was people choosing to take more leisure. They're really quite views that would be very unexpected from the ordinary person in terms of the interpretation of the Great Depression.
I think it's safe to say that both sides on this matter agree that World War II played an important role, whether it was the significant role or one among three roles, that's another matter. But World War II and that huge investment in mobilization by the federal government, does it matter what the government is spending money on? In other words, is there any difference, economically speaking, between the government spending huge amounts of money on running a war, a necessary war, most people would have said at the time, and the government deciding to spend money on things that it's choosing to spend money on, which could include roads and bridges or whatever?
The only thing that should matter is the timing of those expenditures. A lot of the expenditures the government is now planning to undertake may well occur long after the recession is over. But we at the university here stand ready to spend money immediately if the government will just send it our way, and it will be just as valued here as anywhere else.
In the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic's business blog that got the stimulus smackdown started, you wrote, almost no one predicted the worldwide downturn. How can that be?
I'm afraid, even though I'm chair of an economics department, it reflects the fact that really we've had surprisingly little progress in economics since the 1920s. And the terms of this debate between Brad and Michaela are exactly the same terms that were being debated in the 1920s in Britain, and where Michaela would be the Treasury view and Brad would be Keynes. And I'm afraid that, the bizarre irony in economics is that our knowledge has not in any sense expanded with our prestige.
Let's say we get to the end of the current problems and it's apparent that one side or the other had it right on this occasion. Would that resolve the issue? Or is each downturn, each recession, depression, whatever, so unique that you can't draw long-term conclusions from it?
The problem that led us to the current state was that we had a long period of almost uninterrupted prosperity. And as that happened, people's whole attention turned away from from the Great Depression, and turned to a kind of hubris that this couldn't happen again, that we were in a new world. And so my feeling again is that we'll be very strongly governed by what the path of growth looks like in the next 30 years. If there's a lot of turbulence, there'll be more Keynesians. If there's a steady growth path, then it will be quite kind of neoclassical economists will predominate again.
Well, thank you so much. Greg Clark is professor and chair of the Department of Economics at UC Davis. He's also the moderator of the economic stimulus debate, the stimulus smackdown tomorrow evening with the economist you heard earlier, Brad DeLong at Berkeley, and Michaela Boldrin of Washington University in St. Louis. And the debate starts tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate you joining us.
Sure, it's been great. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, ethics and government. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you want to know more about the people and topics you hear on Insight, go to capradio.org/insight. How ethical is government? How can government be made more ethical? What are some of the obstacles? Those are the themes of a one-day conference this week at McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. Local and national experts will discuss ethics and government. The symposium's organizer is law professor Paul Payton. He teaches at McGeorge and directs its Ethics Across the Professions initiative. When he came to our studio the other day, I noted that some people get a little cynical when they hear the words ethics and government in the same sentence. So I asked Paul Payton, how fair is that judgment?
It's hard to do a field-to-field comparison, but everybody looks at government, and you've had an array of scandals that hit the front pages, and everybody relates to those. So, of course, they think politicians are somewhere near, maybe above, maybe below, used car salesmen when it comes to ethics and responsibility. I think that cynicism is unfortunate because you get 98% of people in government at all levels trying to do a good job and trying to do their best, but they're making difficult choices.
Why then do people tend to have the cynicism about the ethics of politicians if, as you say, the great majority are perfectly ethical?
I'm not going to say that they're perfectly ethical. I think I'd like to wish that they are, but I'm an eternal optimist in that respect. I think they're making tough choices that in retrospect sometimes, you know, are subject to scrutiny. But you get these blatant instances of, you know, a governor going to procure prostitutes across the state line. An Alaskan senator who's basically convicted of ethics violations and others who are accused of outright fraud, embezzlement, somebody trying to sell a Senate seat. I mean, these aren't even close to the line. And so in that respect, at least, when you look at a government culture, people become cynical.
Why do you think high-profile politicians do stupid things like that? Because especially in the world today, it's just hard to imagine such things not becoming public at some point.
It's amazing what the internet, what cell phones, what cameras have done. And I think anybody who thinks that they're not under scrutiny for whatever they're doing, the divide between personal and public personas is basically gone. You've got the Obama family under scrutiny in People magazine, in every tabloid, on every television show. There's this aura of invincibility that sometimes surrounds politicians, and maybe for some they're believing their own rhetoric or their own importance, or they're actually making the mistake that the important thing is them rather than the office they occupy.
My guest is Paul Payton, associate professor at McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento and director of the Ethics Across the Professions Initiative. He's the organizer of a one-day symposium this Friday about ethics in government. Now, you're moderating a panel discussion called Creating an Ethical Culture or Overcoming a Corrupt One. How do you create an ethical culture?
That's actually something I'm going to be putting to our panelists, and it's a terrific way to start off the symposium. Professor Lance Cole, who's joining us, held the pen on the 9/11 Commission report, and so he had a front row seat in terms of trying to understand what went sideways in government, who was actually doing what at whatever time. James Loggers, coming from the Government Accountability Office in Washington, he's an ethics officer. He's a senior ethics officer in a government office that's supposed to hold everybody else accountable. I'm going to be asking them, as well as my own colleague Clark Kelso, who is the professor at McGeorge, but also currently receiver of the California prison state prison system, you know, what do you do organizationally to try and make sure that people are in an ethical culture? Is it all about the rules? Is it a message from the top? Do you actually just have to hold certain people accountable from time to time? Is it deterrence? Is it rehabilitation? I've seen different approaches in different governments, and I think our experts will provide a really thoughtful and interesting way to sort of shape and frame that question.
What do you think, though? Do you think it starts with the people in elected office bringing an ethical culture with them, or should it not matter what they arrive with, that there needs to be a rock-solid ethical culture in place before people arrive?
I think it has to be a combination of the two. You are not going to erase what people bring to any environment, whether it's professional or government. People are formed by whatever experiences they've had before they get elected, before they're coming into Washington, if they've been in a state system that has had a level of corruption. And so in that regard, at least, what you're looking at is saying, okay, people are arriving. You want to set a tone. The tone comes from the top. But at the same time, you need a system of rules and checks and balances in place that help people do the right thing and stay on the right path. As I mentioned earlier, you've got a range of choices that people will make. What you want to do is help guide them in that right direction.
But who's going to be doing the guiding? When you're talking about governors, senators, presidents even, who's doing the guiding?
Well, that's that's a really difficult question where you say, okay, the influence has to come from the top. And I think setting the tone is really important. Look at the current administration. I mean, day two, you have an announcement on accountability and transparency and ethics in government being part of this platform that they had articulated last June, now part of the government. But you'd had that from both parties. You'd had that from both of the candidates in the election campaign last year saying ethics matter. And so just by virtue of that message coming from the top, going through the culture, it's important. The cynicism comes when they set rules for everybody else that they themselves don't abide by.
Yes. Paul Payton at McGeorge School of Law. He's the organizer of a one-day conference this Friday about ethics in government. I'd be curious to hear what you make of how government should have approached the Blagojevich issue. Governor Blagojevich, the former governor of Illinois, was being investigated for possibly trying to sell a U.S. Senate seat. And the person that he nominated to fill what was then Senator Obama's Senate seat was Roland Burris, who's a former attorney general. There were people, including President Obama, said, we don't even want to touch Burris because he's associated with Blagojevich, even though at that point no one had pointed to anything that Burris had actually done. How do you think we should approach an issue like that from an ethical point of view? Is it better to just say anything that someone like Blagojevich touches is going to be tainted and therefore we shouldn't look at someone like Burris? Or should we say, hey, look at Burris with fresh eyes?
I'd like to think that we'd give people the benefit of the doubt in that regard, and that guilt by association isn't going to be the operating mode for every decision that any government is making. People in politics will encounter a lot of unsavory characters, Blagojevich probably being no exception. And if you actually put off limits anybody that he'd ever encountered or touched, then you'd be ruling out a lot of very good candidates. In the case of Burris specifically, I understand that they had their investigations, they asked their questions. Whether or not they got complete or thoughtful responses in that regard is another matter. But at least you try and do your due diligence as best you can. And I think in that situation, if Burris is a qualified candidate, why exclude him simply by virtue of a previous association with a governor? You'd expect him to be associated with a governor if he's occupying high office.
Do you think that, generally speaking, laws governing ethics in government are tight enough?
Well, this is something that we're going to have all of our speakers get into during the symposium on Friday, because we move from that broad discussion of, you know, how do you create an ethical culture into a very detailed examination of what are some of the rules? How do you actually create rules to make sure that people abide by them? And, you know, in the specific case in the afternoon session, we're looking at rules around lobbying and lobbyists. And those are difficult, complete, convoluted, and subject to all sorts of investigations. So when you look at rules and creating a kind of rule-based approach, you hope that you hold people in line. And I think we'll get some of the answers from some of the other speakers.
Before you came to Sacramento last year to work at McGeorge, you worked in Canada, and you are Canadian. Most recently, you taught at a university in Ontario, but your career also includes a time as a justice and social policy advisor to the Office of the Premier of Ontario. Your experience of Canadian government, what do you think American government could learn, if anything, about ethics in Canadian government?
There's a loaded question now that I'm here. I think it's dangerous for anybody to look to an outside model and say, you've got it right or you've got it perfect. A lot of it has to be homegrown, and there's so much about American political culture that is very different than a Westminster form of parliament, which Canada has. I think you've got independent constituencies. You have a different set of checks and balances built into the system in U.S. politics, which is very healthy and that other democracies have learned from. That said, in the Canadian context, there is a willingness to do this sort of investigation. There's a wonderful tradition of royal commissions where judges will be appointed to conduct inquiries that are very open in a way that I don't know would be tolerated here in quite the same way. And you don't have in those judicial inquiries the kind of grandstanding that sometimes goes on in Congress. I think when congressional investigations are taking place, it's understandable. They want to score partisan points. But an air of neutrality, I think, in terms of the investigation, can sometimes lead to better results, but government has to be willing to implement them.
You mentioned royal commissions in Canada, and that got me thinking of the 9/11 commission that was generally regarded to be a successful process in the United States. But oftentimes when you hear talk about commissions, and there's talk now of setting up a commission to look into what led to the housing and the credit crash in the United States, you know, what caused it all, what can be learned from it. Oftentimes, at least in the United States, people say, oh, no point in looking backwards. Forget about the blame game. Let's move forward. That's what you often hear. Can you move forward ethically without looking to the past and without maybe even blaming some people?
Well, it was interesting. I actually latched onto that expression when I did an op-ed a couple of weeks ago looking at what was going on in baseball and the fact that, well, we've had all of this discussion. Let's just move forward. I think if you don't unpack and learn from what happened before, you're bound to either repeat the mistakes or leave yourself vulnerable to having them abused at some point. So in that regard, at least, setting up some sort of inquiry into the financial crisis is only useful if it doesn't turn into the blame game and you focus on forward solutions. That said, you need to understand why things were going on and also what government's role was in that. I mean, you need to look at all of the players. And I think one of the concerns that I had when you had President Bush talking at the first stages about the financial crisis was that the series of unfortunate events, if you will, that ended up starting the whole thing didn't include, in his analysis, a role for government. Well, everything has to be out on the table. And if they're not willing to engage in that kind of self-scrutiny, it's going to be very difficult to indeed move forward.
What about lobbying? Again, this is another thing that is, for many people, considered almost a dirty word, that lobbying is considered to be almost inherently unethical, that there's a seamy side to it. But lobbyists and some politicians say lobbyists are just representatives of people like you and me in our own separate special interests. How do you think we should look at lobbying and lobbyists from an ethical perspective?
Well, often those lobbyists are better paid than you and me in terms of representing those special interests. But I think the notion of lobbying is often considered a completely dirty word. And I can say from having worked inside government, having had people lobby me, they weren't lobbying me, they were lobbying my office. And I think that's an important distinction. Lobbyists often play a very important role in terms of helping government shape and frame responses. They can provide information and expertise from the special interests, to be sure, that end up helping make better policy. So if it's actually a policy-focused lobbying rather than the you need to do this for my special interest group or you will pay at the polls the next time there's an election, that is a bit of a problem. I think the other really unseemly side of lobbying has to do with cash and has to do with donations that are targeted from special interest groups, and those are the ones that need very careful rules and very careful scrutiny. Our panel that's going to be looking in our special afternoon session focus on lobbying includes a professor who's basically written the book on lobbying, as well as the former head of the American Federation of Lobbyists. They've got two different perspectives, and also a McGeorge grad who has worked very extensively on lobbying here in Sacramento. So we'll have a state and federal and national approach in terms of that discussion and dialogue. I'm hoping we'll get some answers.
To a certain extent in the United States, money given to politicians and to political causes in the context of a campaign is legally considered a form of speech and therefore is protected. And there's a big divide in the United States between people who say you just need to keep getting tougher and tougher and tougher on it until it becomes hard for people to use political money unethically. There's another field that say there are just too many well-paid lawyers who are going to figure out new ways around the laws. Better to just open it all up and have mandatory full disclosure. What do you think is a better path?
I have to say, blaming the lawyers isn't going to be the answer. So in that respect, at least, looking at the kinds of constraints, the kinds of checks and balances, and the key words are accountability and transparency. You know, if you're going to have people who engage in this form of speech and want to give money for their causes, for their politicians, if it's open, if it's transparent, it's accountable in terms of what's going on, it's not building a deck on somebody's house or providing them with home renovations that somehow get buried in lost reports, as you had suggestions of with a senator in Alaska. The issue really becomes, how do you make sure that the money that's going in doesn't get lost or doesn't actually end up persuading somebody to make a decision simply based on graft?
Finally, Paul, although you've been to the United States before when you were at Stanford for a while, most of your life and career has been spent in Canada. You've been in the United States, Sacramento, for a few months. Is there anything that you've noticed in either local or state or federal government from an ethical perspective where you go, oh my goodness, that's kind of odd. Something needs to be done about that.
I couldn't have landed here at a more interesting time. The middle of debate and voting on various propositions here in California, hugely controversial in terms of the way that the money was being accounted for, a very direct form of democracy and democratic participation. You have state budget issues and the question of whether or not certain Republicans should be turfed out of their own caucus simply by virtue of having made a decision that they think is in the best interest of the state. And at the federal level, you've had a sea change in administration and in approach. So on all three levels, there's a lot to keep me busy. And I think in looking at it, what I remain absolutely astounded by and always have been very passionate about is the pride of Americans in their form of government, warts and all, and in making it better. And that relentless optimism in the midst of a financial crisis, in the midst of political crisis, I think will end up driving the United States once again to provide that kind of guidance to the rest of the world.
Paul Payton, Associate Professor at McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento and Director of the Ethics Across the Professions Initiative. He's the organizer of a one-day symposium this Friday about ethics in government. Paul Payton, thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted to be here with you this afternoon.
The public can attend the ethics event, but registration is required at the McGeorge website. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the art of DJing with local artist DJ Oasis. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Stream us at capradio.org/insight. There's a mashup tomorrow night at downtown Sacramento's Capitol Garage. The music's provided by two local DJs. One of them, DJ Oasis, joins us with some of his tracks and to explain how he creates them. DJ Oasis, welcome to Insight.
How's it going?
Well, I'm doing well. How did you get started as a DJ?
Basically, when I was 10 years old, my grandma had passed away. And to sort of pick up a hobby, my grandpa took me to a local pawn shop and we purchased turntables because I was real into it at the time. I had a lot of different cousins that were doing different hip-hop stuff. So I picked up turntables and sort of played with those for a couple years. Got real serious into like the little breakdancing scene, playing jazz loops and breakdancing beats. By the time I got to high school, that whole little scene and area and music started dying out. So with that dying out, I sort of lost my spirit in DJing and just picked it up again maybe about 4 years ago, came back. My friend DJ Royale had started DJing and he was looking at me for a couple pointers and, you know, really got me back into it. So since then, I've been really on my grind and working hard at this DJing stuff.
My guest is DJ Oasis. He's at Capitol Garage at the Wednesday night mashup in downtown Sacramento tomorrow night. It starts at 10. Let's listen to one of your tracks. This is how Well Connected starts.
Hello? Hey, yo, what's up? What's good with you, Nick? Man, nothing, just yelling, where you at? Man, bro, I gotta take this little trip real quick. I'm finna hit the Bay, Fairfield and shit. You already know I got my peoples out there. Then I'm finna hit Texas, then LA, then I'll be back to Sac. What's good?
Shit, dude, when you get back,
I don't forget at you, man.
All right. go to Sac Town. They do it a day.
Relax and take notes. Who the hot is this? Hot 'cause I'm fly, 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 fly. You ain't 'cause you're not.
That's Well Connected by my guest DJ Oasis. The song that you sampled there is that 70s pop classic, yeah. Baby Come Back. Why did you choose that song?
I was actually going through a wide range of old records, and I found that song, and I just heard a couple instruments and a couple loops that I could play with, so I just started looping a couple things, added some drums, and before I knew it, like, the beat came out like incredible, and a lot of artists wanted to get on that. I decided to keep it for myself, though, and really do like a real intro.
Yeah. You know, the original song, Baby Come Back, it's got a kind of cheesy vibe to it, yeah. And yet it sounds almost sinister the way you use it.
Yeah, and that was one of the main things. A lot of people were like, oh my God, is that song from all the commercials and this and that? And I was like, yeah, like, I went through it and cut it up and like made a beat out of it, and the beat came out crazy.
How did you learn how to do loops and things like that as a DJ? Because you said you started when you were 10. Did someone show you how to do it, or did you figure it out?
Well, as I stopped DJing in high school, a couple buddies of mine, Mr. Trax and Nicotine, were really doing the production and making hip-hop beats and just beats in general. And I would sit there a lot of nights and watch them, and they'd show me a couple things, and I just started picking it up like as they showed me. So, like, as I came back to DJing again, I just started putting everything together. And, like, as you hear on that track, it has me scratching as a DJ, and I did the production on it. So I just started putting everything together.
Let's listen to another one of your tracks. This I love this one. This is Vegas Mix Part 2. DJ Oasis, if you were doing that live, could you do that, what we're listening to right now, could you do all of that live just with your own two hands?
Yeah, and that's like one of the things you're going to be hearing tomorrow, as far as like, that's what we call a mashup, when you take two popular records, combine them together to make one song. So that you're going to be hearing a lot of that tomorrow at the Capitol Garage, and that's really like, as far as my next move in music and as a DJ, is going to be in the clubs and really like hitting everybody hard with that type of mashup stuff and doing like songs like that. And I have a whole lot of a big category that I'm going to run through tomorrow.
Are you doing that with records and turntables?
Yeah. It's with two turntables, a mixer, and this new program that a lot of DJs are using nowadays called Serato, which is basically a laptop hooked into your mixer. And you're sort of like just using the songs on your laptop as sort of a MIDI controller with the turntables, and you're just running through songs, and it's like the new era of DJing.
Do the really old school guys think it's cheating to use a laptop or something like that?
No, because you see like the major DJs that, you know, when I first started, I looked up to, as far as like Jazzy Jeff and DJ Premier and all these people, Kid Capri, and everybody just switched over to Serato because you're still using regular records, turntables, needles, but you're using a laptop to hold your music instead of carrying 80 crates of records to your gigs. So it just makes it a lot easier.
Now, you're just in your early 20s, but I'm sure that there are kids who are 10, like you were when you started, who are doing their own DJing. Are they doing stuff where you're going, man, I wish I could have done that when I was 10, or nah, that's cheating?
Oh, yeah. And with that, like, you go on YouTube and there'll be a 9-year-old kid somewhere in the U.S. that's just incredible at DJing. And just nowadays, like, kids are picking up stuff and running with it so good nowadays. It's like it's awing the people that have been doing this for years.
My guest is DJ Oasis. Let's listen to one more track, Hip Hop Mix.
Yeah, DJ Oasis.
DJ Oasis, you're going to Vegas later this month, and then you're going to Europe in late May, early June. So yeah. Things are taking off, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And with that, you know, like, as I'm just, like, progressing with different people, I work with the artist. I'm a personal DJ for this artist, Doey Rock, which is pretty big in Sacramento and works with a lot of people out in the industry throughout the U.S. And he actually set the European trip up. So we're going out there for a week, going to Netherlands, Germany, Amsterdam. And also, you know, with the Vegas thing, like, I'm going down there through some friends and DJing at the Hard Rock. I forget the date on that.
18, 19, 20 March.
Yeah, yeah. And that's all on my MySpace. And just, like, things like that. Like, I'm going to a lot of places, different places to DJ. And it's incredible that, you know, I do a lot of things like that, but in my own home, Sacramento, I don't get a lot of big clubs, and it's sort of outstanding.
Well, we appreciate you joining us today on Insight. DJ Oasis, he's at Capitol Garage at the Wednesday Night Mashup. It's in downtown Sacramento tomorrow night at 10 with DJ Matt Kelly, and he's got all sorts of other things going on coming up. DJ Oasis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's associate producers on Insight were Lynn Weaver and Nathan Wilkinson. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Is a simple ballot majority sufficient to amend the Constitution? That's one of the arguments California justices will soon decide in the Prop 8 case. On the next Insight, experts will take us through the process. Also, the Sacramento Bee's Marcus Bertone weighs in on some of the other top stories in the news. And local alternative band All on 7 performs live in our studio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Capital Public Radio.